Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Report podcast. And this is the third Monday of the month. So as usual, that means it is time for film, literature, and the New World Order. And as we announced at the end of the podcast last month, this month we're going to be covering They Live, the 1988 flick by John Carpenter, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper, who you may or may not remember from your childhood watching WWF back when it was called WWF, if you, like me, grew up in a city that was defined by wrestling. But at any rate, we are going to delve into this, surprisingly prescient movie. I don't know how to even describe it, because it is so interesting the way that it's developed into more than I think even its creators intended. But in order to help dissect this movie and what's behind it and what the real story of They Live might really be, today we're going to be joined by none other than Guillermo Jimenez of tracesofreality.com. Our old friend Guillermo, how are you doing today, Guillermo?
I'm doing just fine, James. Thanks so much for inviting me onto the film and literature series. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, let's just start by talking about this movie. This was suggested by you. So why don't we just start talking about why it is that you wanted to cover this movie in particular?
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, you know, it's a fun movie, first of all. And as you said, you know, I am one of those people that grew up watching as a young boy the WWF, as you say, back when it was still called the WWF. And so I remember watching this as a young kid, actually. I'm 30, almost, no wait, am I 32 now? I forget.
But you've so already reached that age, yeah, where it doesn't even matter.
A little bit. But anyway, so what I was going to say is that, you know, the film came out when I was still very, very young. And I saw it, you know, in the early 90s the first time around. And of course, I mean, I was still a young kid. I was watching it because Roddy Piper's in it. I didn't really understand it then. And it wasn't until I came back to it much later that things started to connect. And it was, like you said, it's become one of those movies that over time has come to mean a lot more than even John Carpenter himself perhaps even meant it to mean. And I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about that, actually, as far as what the creator of the film's motivations might have been in making it, what his intent might have been, compared to how it's been perceived over time. But as you say, you know, there's really so much about this movie we can talk about. This is the reason I picked it, is because it's such a strange sort of piece of art, because it, on, you know, on the surface, it's this really cheesy, really corny 80s, almost B-level type movie as far as the dialogue anyway. Just really cheesy throwaway one-liners throughout, which make it great. But superficially, that's what's going on. But then there's really, you know, overt messages, socially conscious messages throughout the film that really make it much more than that, you know, your classic 80s B-level movie. And so, yeah, I think that dynamic, that dichotomy, I suppose, is what attracts me to the film. And of course, you know, these days, the movies become, as you say, a sort of cultural phenomenon. Plenty of pulp culture references to the movie have been made. Most famously, I suppose, most recently by Shepard Fairey, who is famous for that Obama Hope poster, who's also similarly famous for that the Obey poster that he created featuring the face of Andre the Giant, another WWF figure from the 80s, that I think most people now are familiar with, that image with the big bold type Obey right underneath it. That is a throwback to the film. And so, yeah, I think it's very, very, very relevant. And we can talk a little bit about, you know, how it plays into the sort of parallels that we see today with the modern day structure of geopolitical craziness.
Craziness being the operative word there. Well, you're right. Exactly right. Well, I it's interesting because I have a vague recollection of perhaps maybe seeing this movie when I was young. I mean, it seems like the kind of movie I probably would have watched with my brothers, mm-hmm, at some point, but I don't have a specific memory of watching it. So the first time I really watched it was a few years ago. I watched it for the first time, and it was. I mean, obviously, having watched it after having started the Corbett Report and everything that I'm doing, I mean, it really hits you that it almost seems like it was crafted around the sort of alt media movement that's been created in the past decade or so on the internet. And of course, it makes you think that, well, this information has been around for a while. So, I mean, is it out there in the ether? Who's been propagating this before? But then when you actually start to look into John Carpenter and his expressed intentions around this, I mean, he doesn't give a lot of interviews and he doesn't talk a lot about his work. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhat difficult to get a good handle on. But everything that I've read has basically said that John pretty much saw the aliens as representative of Republicans.
Right.
And I think that was most obviously in that scene where he's in the supermarket or wherever he is, the grocery store, where there's the politician on the screen giving the speech, and he says something like a new morning or a new day, and it was like, I mean, clearly a Reagan reference. Exactly. I mean, I think it can definitely be read that way, and of course, I mean, the real overriding feel of the movie in the first opening act is definitely the economic crisis. Mm. The 14 banks went under in a week, and he's looking for work. He has to live in this homeless encampment. They're talking about, you know, I believe in America, that kind of thing. So it's definitely got that 80s economic crisis kind of undertone to it, and I can see definitely how it could have come out of that. But as you say, I mean, there's so many things about this movie that are so prescient about things that we cover in the alt media today. And I was just making a list of things as I was going through the movie in preparation for this conversation. The economic crisis, which obviously, I mean, we're still dealing with various aspects of that, and the disparity between the ultra-rich and the ultra-poor. Subliminals delivered through television and mass media. Electronic mind control. Alien species ruling over humanity. spy drones. Humans bribed to join the alien system. Geoengineering. Infighting amongst those who are awake over how to act about it. All of these things are issues that have been covered in one way or another by the alt media in recent years. So again, I just thought it was so completely prescient, this movie. And it really does make you wonder, I mean, perhaps it wasn't even intentional, but there's clearly something in the ether or something out there that people recognize about this theme. I mean, this theme transcends, I think, just the specifics of how it was created.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, this movie, as you said, you know, it just, as you described, rather, it really does have everything. And, you know, before we get into perhaps how it relates to today's world, I did want to go back and touch on a little bit more what you brought up, which is the lead character in the film played by Roddy Piper, who is nameless in the movie. He's never named, doesn't provide his name. It's only until the credits that he's listed as Nada, which means nothing. but that you know, you and I were talking about this a little bit earlier, and so that actually comes from the short story that the film is based on. The lead character is George Nada. Maybe we can talk about the short story a little bit later, but anyway, so that's I think that in itself is something, that this is a nameless drifter going about traveling to Los Angeles. As you said, he's coming from a place where all the banks have closed down, and he's looking for work in this economic crisis. And, you know, he can't find work, and he stumbles upon this massive conspiracy, and it's up to him to solve everything. But in the beginning of the movie, he's you know, he delivers that line where, you know, I still believe in America, and I'm just going to work hard and wait for my opportunity. So he's like very much that sort of, you know, Johnny American, you know, Joe Schmo, anybody, any town USA sort of thing. And so that's an interesting sort of thing that happens there at the beginning of the movie. But and then it hits you right away. I mean, like 5 minutes into the film, you're introduced to the street preacher, and already you're hearing about how, you know, where the world is being run by an elite who treat us like cattle. We're slaves to the system. And it's just over the top, in your face from the go, from beginning to end, practically. And so it's a very powerful thing about the film. But also something you mentioned about how it speaks so well to the sort of things that we talk about regularly. But what I found so curious about this was, just when the film came out back in 1988. And as we said earlier, this is, you know, John Carpenter has done a couple of interviews on the subject. And as you said, he said basically that it was a reaction to the Reagan years. This is, 88 is the year, the last year of Reagan's second term in office. When the film was being made, George H.W. Bush has just, is in the process of securing the nomination en route to succeeding Reagan. So it's in that sort of culture and that sort of society that this movie is being made and being delivered. But what I find so curious is that, as you said, has got so much of what the stuff that we talk about today about the power global elite. And yet it was made in the 80s, back when this stuff really wasn't talked about nearly at the level that it's talked about today. I mean, the ideas of the New World Order, for example, those have been around for a while, for probably 100 years, if not more, but really picked up steam in this sort of context, within the context of a sort of global conspiracy in the 1970s. But it was really limited to books and small circulation magazines and newsletters. So 88 is also still 3 years before George H.W. Bush delivered his now infamous New World Order speech before Congress. So we're talking about a very, very small number of people who would have been familiar with this idea relative to today, certainly, but even relative to even, just before, just after 9/11 even. So we have this film, again, that's so cheesy, so corny, but a brilliant film that an established director coming out of Hollywood essentially putting forth this the New World Order conspiracy theory in everything but name, sort of speaking in code in a way. At least that's, how I would see it or read it. And yet at the time when it came out, only a tiny, tiny fraction of the audience would have made that connection, right, if any. And so that's what I find so curious about a film like this, because in today's world, a film like this, it probably wouldn't work. The parallels are probably too obvious. The message is maybe too in your face. It's almost like beating people over the head with things that they generally know or at least have heard before. Today's audience probably requires a little something more subtle. But for 1988, the audiences that came to see the film and that watched it through the 90s and maybe even the early 2000s, the film was perfect for them.
To be honest, you started by saying it's a fun movie, and I think it absolutely is a fun movie. It holds up today as just an extremely watchable 90 minutes. And yeah, it's an action movie if you just want it to be an action movie, but it obviously has all of these incredible undertones. And I think the glasses is just the absolute perfect visual metaphor. It is absolutely just brilliantly done. And it's such a powerful scene when he puts on the glasses and starts seeing the world. It's so brilliantly done. And so I like the way it's just so stark. It's just black lettering on white backgrounds, obey mm-hmm. and consume and all of this. And it's just such a contrast to all of the, the bright, vivid, multicolor advertisements and things that we see, but underneath it's all the same message and it's all very basic. And I just thought that was, it's just such a brilliant, brilliant way of visualizing that. And I suppose we could talk about how prescient this is for 1988, but then, as you mentioned before, we could go back to the 1963 short story that it's based on, in which George Nada, as you say, wakes up from a trance after being hypnotized. He wakes up all the way, as he writes. I love that. It's such a nice little opening. And so he starts seeing what is described in that story as the Fascinators, who are basically some type of reptile type beings. And that's interesting because, of course, now
the reptilians.
Exactly. Well, I mean, now that's an idea. If you wrote that story today, you'd be like, oh, it's a David Icke kind of thing.
Right.
But exactly. I don't know where I really don't know the origins of the reptilian kind of idea. Perhaps it preceded Icke, but clearly he's the biggest progenitor of it. So, again, this being written 50 years ago, it seems to me in both cases, I'm willing to take John Carpenter and the author of the 8 o'clock in the morning, the story this is based on, I'm willing to take their word at it that it was based on Republicans, or it was about, it was just a silly sci-fi story. But clearly mm-hmm. it touches on themes that are very applicable. And I think again, this is the sense that everyone has, that there is something underlying the system that we see that's going on. This isn't just random chance or just, you know, people who work hard get ahead in the system. There's clearly some sort of structure underneath. And I think that's a pretty universal theme that they've tapped into. And as I say, just in a visual sense, just brilliantly done in this movie.
And I think you're absolutely right. The word that came to mind as you were talking about this was universal, in the sense that sort of theme, that there's more than meets the eye. There's something beneath the surface. That's a very, very universal theme and concept throughout literature, throughout art and things like this. And so I think that's very, very true. And to go back to what you said about the reptilians, I mean, that connection, I guess, has to be made. We're almost obliged to make it, because, I mean, it correlates so perfectly with David Icke's shtick about the shape-shifting reptilians, that I would be surprised if he wasn't directly influenced by the film or the short story in some way, because it's too perfect. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I've heard him make reference to V before, but I've never heard him make specific reference to V.
Well, when did V come out? Because that's the original V is also, what is that? Was that from the 80s or 70s?
Yeah. I remember the television series in the 80s. I don't know the kind of origins of that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's based on a novel or of some kind.
I have to go back and revisit that. Maybe that's enough future FLNW. But yeah, no. That idea again, it seems. Yeah. There seems to be something more.
The short story, though, one of the things that really stuck out to me, that there's a phrase in that short story, and it relates to the film, absolutely. Again, going back to that character of that loner, him against the world, just doing this on his own, you know, and there's a line in the short story that's repeated twice, and it's what can one man do, or what could one man do? And as George Nada is going about this crazy day of his, where he's waking up, has awakened. And that's another thing we can talk about, just that word alone and what that means. In today's sort of culture.
Yeah.
But so he's awake and he's having this crazy day. He gets a phone call where he's told he's going to die the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning. But he's at a hypnotist or something, and then he wakes up all the way, and now he can see for the first time what there really is, and he sees these reptilian looking aliens instead of the human form sort of disappears, and he sees them for what they are. And but anyway, so he's going about this by himself, and he keeps repeating to himself, you know, well, yeah, so I see this, but really, what can I do? And he notices that the more he starts to realize what's really happening, the more nervous the aliens start to get, the more nervous these fascinators start to get. And he keeps wondering, you know, but this can't be happening, right? I can't be having this much of an effect. I'm just one person. What can one man do? But by the end of it, he realizes that, yes, I can do something. And I think towards the end of the short story, it's very, very short, by the way, for those of you who have not checked it out. It's literally 5 pages long. You can get through it in about 10, 15 minutes. But by the end of the story, he has realized that all it takes for him to wake everyone up is to shatter the illusion, I think one line, I think I wrote this down, actually, cause it's a good line. Oh, so you see, the power of the illusion was it has to believe it can master me to do it. The slightest hint of fear on its part and the power to hypnotize is lost. And so once he realizes that all he has to do is shake these people into thinking that, you know, we're on to you. I know your game here. I can see you for what you are. The illusion fades. Everyone wakes up, and it leads to some kind of world war or something in the book. And so, but the good guys win is the moral of that story.
Yeah, that story is so short that it's it just glosses over entire.
Right,
you know,
the war is like one line. It's like literally one sentence.
But interestingly enough, in that story, he ends up dying at 8 o'clock in the morning, exactly as he was told to in that story, which has some interesting implications for the story, because then, I mean, it means that there really remains that influence, and people remain susceptible, I guess, to it in that world. So, and of course, similarly in the movie, I mean, Nada ends up dying in the movie as well, in sacrificing himself to sort of save humanity, again, by disrupting a television broadcast, because again, TV is the method through which this deception is being woven, right. Or at least one of the main
Media mind control again.
And explicitly, there's the people who break in on the signal that are based in this homeless camp where Nada is staying, and the person who's delivering that message is saying specifically it's some sort of something embedded in the signal itself, the television signal, and it's 24/7. Even if you have the television turned off, it's still coming through. And
hey, doesn't that sound familiar? It sounds like my smartphone.
Exactly. No, I mean it is. I mean it's just so incredible the way that again it relates so much to what we talk about. But yes, I mean clearly the message of this is that it is a type of hypnosis that we're under, that it's almost like a sleep-like consciousness, I think the person says on the broadcast. And again, I mean, that's exactly the sort of consciousness that we're constantly confronting when we're trying to tell information about what's really happening in the world, which is why, I mean, this is such a perfect metaphor. And I think, I don't know, but I assume that the reason that the alt media in this day and age uses the term awake and uses it in that way is probably because of movies like this. I think this movie helped give a language to the movement that then arose, which is why it's, when we look back at it now, it looks so much like what we think the alt media looks like.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the language, I think, is key. It does. We use a lot of the same language when talking about what it is that we do and what, you know, what's displayed in the film. And, you know, of course, you have that group that Nada joins very early on. He stumbles upon this church where there people are gathering, where there's just people that do see, who are awake, but he doesn't quite know what they're doing. They look kind of fishy, and he goes to investigate. But there's a scene in the film where he walks in, and on the wall in huge letters, I think it's graffiti or chalk or something, it's written, "They live, we sleep." And that might be the first reference to the sleep awake sort of thing. But it's very early in the film. But then it sort of plays on that throughout. You know, you hear all throughout the film, you know, we need to wake people up. We need to show them what it is that's really going on. And they refer to themselves as revolutionaries. And they talk about how, you know, they need to take down this you know, global elite conspiracy. The parallels are so striking, but where was I going with that? I wanted to mention something about that the language, but I forgot exactly what I was going to say, but I'll come back to that.
Well, let's pick up there on the idea of these revolutionaries and sort of the way that they're positioned in this story, because I think there's obvious analogies. I don't know how explicit they are, but obviously this type of story goes all the way back to Plato, right? The allegory of the cave. So watching the shadows on the wall, you think the shadows are reality, but then someone is able to break their chains and get up outside and see the sun and see the real world and realize that people are just watching shadows on a wall. So what happens in the cave allegory, the person returns to the cave and Socrates says to Glaucon, wouldn't he remember his first home, what passed for wisdom there and his fellow prisoners, and consider himself happy and them pitiable? And wouldn't he disdain whatever honors, praises, and prizes were awarded there to the ones who guessed best which shadows followed which? Moreover, were he to return there, wouldn't he be rather bad at their game, no longer being accustomed to the darkness? Wouldn't it be said of him that he went up and came back with his eyes corrupted, and that it's not even worth trying to go up? And if they were somehow able to get their hands on and kill the man who attempts to release and lead them up, wouldn't they kill him? Which is, again, I mean, I guess we could talk about how prescient Plato was or in all of this. But that really is kind of one of the fundamental things that they're dealing with, the people who are awake in this movie, because they're wondering, well, how can we affect change? What can we do? And then, of course, there's the people, you know, it's time for us to spill some blood. Yay.
Yeah.
And then there's the other one. No, we've got to bide our time and we've got to wake people
it's
up.
It's not time yet. Yeah, exactly. I think it's exactly what he says. Now, that might be the line where, there's a scene where they're sort of arguing about, you know, should we act now? And then he says, no, we need to wake people up first. And so, there's just so much. But there's one thing that I mean, what you were talking about with Plato, I mean, that just speaks to how universal, again, these themes are. But, what's also really interesting about the film is how these things are interspliced with, you know, counter consumerism messages and things like this, more for a modern audience. And one of the scenes that really struck me as I was watching this film again recently is it when it's cutting between you know, what Nada can actually see for the world as it is, as it really is, and what he's at, what, you know, what everyone else is looking at. And there's scenes like there's commercials for you know, press on nails or something, and some sort of fashion ad. And there's a woman talking about how, you know, when she, oh, there's an interview of a woman talking about how much she loves watching soap operas and television because she can escape and feel important for a short time and feel loved. And that's a word that, you know, speaking of language, that really struck me also in watching it, is, you know, the love that one can feel, I suppose, from fiction and from escaping from your life for a short time. And on that note, as far as that escape, there's also that dynamic between Nada and Frank, his best buddy, right? The guy he befriends at the construction site. And, you know, when Nada first discovers, you know, what's really going on, he, of course, wants to, you know, tell others and share it with as many people as he can. And his friend, his best buddy, doesn't want to hear it. And he says something to the effect of, you know, hey, I don't want to know about that, man. I got a wife and kids. You know, I got a wife and kids. You keep your own problems. I don't want to hear about it. And again, that's so the parallels are there between, you know, what someone who's listening to this perhaps might have experienced when talking to friends and family about things they were learning about or reading about or studying. And you probably often got reactions like that from friends and family saying, you know, I've got my own problems. I've got a mortgage to pay and kids to feed and raise. I really don't want to hear it. And, you know, I think we have actually talked about this before. The symbolism behind that fight scene, right, between Frank and Nada, where Nada, you know, physically forces Frank to see, you know, how aggressive, I guess, one can be or should be with that message. They literally beat the shit out of each other for about 5 minutes, and then he forces him to put on the glasses, and he finally is like, oh, you were right all along.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, again, just such, it's the perfect metaphor for the struggle that I think we've all faced in trying to get other people to see the information. And I wrote that down as well. Nada says to Frank, you ain't, I got something to show you. And he says, you ain't showing me anything. I got a wife and kids, so just leave me alone, which is exactly right. I mean, I've got a wife and kids, you know, I'm too invested in the system. I don't want to know what you know. And then later on in the fight, just before the fight scene, Nada says, I'm trying to save you and your family's life. And Frank says, you couldn't even save your own. So again, I exactly the type of scene that's, I'm sure we've all played out metaphorically, hopefully. I would hope not too many people have been involved in a fight scene like that. The fight
Epic
scene.
Fight scene, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. The fight scene, quite famous in film history, I would say, for being, well, probably one of the longest single fight scenes in any action movie.
It's been parodied on South Park, I think. Yeah, I've seen that. Jimmy and
I don't
Timmy,
think I saw that.
I think, no, I think the creators, I think I heard one time that they were really proud of the fact that they were able to, the like blow by blow, like they copied the entire scene.
Awesome. But yeah, but so clearly the fight to put the glasses on someone else is one of the fundamental struggles that Nada has to face in this. And then, of course, it's the question, well, how do we do this to society at large? And they decide to target the TV studio. But yeah. But if the glasses then are a metaphor, what are they a metaphor for? I mean, at one point he says, you know, we have to get these glasses to everyone or something along those lines. No, we can't be the only ones who see. We have to find who made these glasses or something like that.
Oh, I don't catch that one. What I found interesting about the glasses, just real quick on that same note about the glasses, is something else he said that I found kind of worth noting is he mentions to Frank, you know, oh, well, you know, don't wear this for too long, man. He said, you know, after a while, it'll feel like a screwdriver in your head or something like a knife being drilled into your head. I forget the exact line, but basically, you know, it'll be too painful if all you do is look through these glasses all the time. So take them off every now and then. So, We can, you know, also sort of metaphorical.
That's right. But then when they go to the whatever that place where they're all the people who are awake are there, the revolutionaries, they get some kind of contacts or something that work better. So
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if that's an extended metaphor or if maybe it just breaks down there. But if the glasses are a metaphor, what are they a metaphor for? Well, clearly, I mean, the glasses are tracesofreality.com. The glasses are corporatereport.com. The glasses are all these, you know, people out there scattered around the world who are trying to show this to other people and have the technology to do it, the specs to show people what the world for what it really is. And so many people will refuse to take a look. Again, just, I mean, it's so completely germane to what we're doing that it's pretty amazing. And I guess, I mean, we could continue talking about sort of the analogies of it, but let's think about how this actually impacted, society. As I say, I think that clearly the people who are involved in this, in the alt media, and the people who were starting it were big fans of this movie, which is, I think, why some of this, these ideas and images and language has worked its way into the alt media. I mean, explicitly, Alex Jones is a huge fan, and he did an interview with Roddy Piper not so long ago for the 25th anniversary of They Live. So I'll put that in the show notes for people who are interested to hear Roddy Piper talking about the movie. But in terms of the society at large, what was the effect of this movie? I have no idea. I'm just looking at IMDb. Apparently, the budget for the movie was about $4 million, and it ended up grossing about $13 million in the U.S. anyway. So I a moderate success, right? I mean,
was that those numbers up to date or
I believe so.
Like,
but
over time,
it says opening weekend was $4.8 million, which is pretty impressive on 1,463 screens. Well, yeah. I saw a clip of Keith David, the man who plays Frank in the movie, at an event with Roddy Piper, and they were talking about this, and Keith said something to the effect of, for 2 weeks, it was the number one movie in the nation, and then it just suddenly disappeared from theaters. and he said, "Well, it must have pissed someone off."
Yeah,
and I don't know the truth of that. I don't know if it was the number one. 4.8 million back in 1988 sounds like it probably was the number one movie for opening weekend. But I really don't know. But that,
yeah,
I mean, that's certainly
for inflation.
Interesting.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, add a few zeros. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so I don't know, but I mean that wouldn't particularly surprise me if that was the case.
No, I mean, Piper was a big name in the 80s, after all. He's a big star in the WWF scene. You know, this is a time when other wrestlers of that time were making movies, Andre the Giant making The Princess Bride. You have Hulk Hogan making all kinds of movies. And so I guess I'm not, initially when you said the numbers, I was surprised, but I guess upon further reflection, I'm not that surprised. Although that is curious to know that I did not know that the film all of a sudden just up and disappeared from theaters.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to see if I can dig up anything more on that. But that, again, it wouldn't really surprise me. But that's just our conspiratorial thinking, right?
Sure.
We've got one that can see. All right. Well, again, I mean, just a brilliant film. I hope people really did enjoy watching this. I mean, even just as a movie, I think it's just fun. But obviously, it has some deeper implications. Any other parts that you wanted to dissect here?
Oh man, there's really so much. There's so many different lines that you know we can talk about as metaphors. I guess just one real quick thing, just to throw it out because I bothered to write it down. there's a scene where Piper's character looks over at the newsstand, and that's when you see most of these messages. The black and white, really stark and big bold, obey and consume. But there's a couple of more subtle messages that you almost have to pause, which I did. You almost have to pause the movie to read them. And some of them I found very, very, I guess, striking is the word. It's just when he's looking at those magazines on the newsstands, you know, you see the ones that you've seen throughout the movie already, consume and obey and marry and reproduce and things like this. But you also see a couple you don't see too often in the movie, and it's honor apathy is one that really struck me, and doubt humanity is another one. And you only see those two that I can remember anyway, that I noticed. You only see those two when looking at that newsstand or looking at a news magazine or things like that. You see doubt humanity and honor apathy. And just, again, you make that connection between mass media and its real function in society. And that's a lot of what the film talks about, I suppose, in that sort of message that it delivers. But I guess that's just the one thing that I wanted to point out from the movie. But I guess go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, honor apathy, I think that clearly relates to that message that the man in the interrupted TV broadcast is talking about, how they want you to not care or something along those lines. The other one, what was that again?
Doubt humanity.
Interesting. Yeah. So obey your reptilian overlords and doubt the people around you. Well, again, and of course, it's always about the infighting and fighting with each other when, of course, there's this actual alien species ruling over us. Maybe we should concentrate on them before we start fighting with each other, which I think, again, has a lot of is very apt for our current situation. Well, let's also, I think we should probably address, I mean, the way that the sort of the structure of this system of oppression works in the film, which interestingly is geared towards the geoengineering of the planet to make it more hospitable for the aliens. Or I believe that was what they're implying because of the rising chlorofluorocarbons and whatever the sort of 80s environmental concerns that they threw in there as sort of like, oh, they're engineering the planet. Which was interesting, and they treat the Earth basically as we treat a third world country, just to exploit it for its resources and you know, move on. So obviously very interesting from that analogy, but also interesting because of the way that it works, where you have these cooperative human beings who know that these are, you know, this alien species that's just basically using them, but hey, they get to live the good life, which again I think speaks very powerfully to the type of situation we're in, because I think that I suppose we have the enemy, quote unquote, of the fellow human beings who just won't look at the glasses, who won't put on the glasses. But more importantly, the enemy are the people who will cooperate with the system, knowing full well what it is, simply because they get some benefit out of it. And I think that's kind of the image of the super elite versus the so-called elite, just the people who make, you know, a few million dollars a year because they are good toadies to power, and they will serve the people in power. And again, I think that's really instructive about the situation we're in.
Yeah, indeed. No, that is the pecking order in the film, and both in the real world, in a way. One quick thing about that line, though, about the third world, that's actually one that I wrote down, because it plays right into at least the stated purpose by John Carpenter of the movie, is sort of anti-Reagan, anti-capitalist type of message. There is that line by one of the characters who I don't remember his name. I think it might have been Gilbert, that lead revolutionary before Piper joins. He calls the aliens, they're free enterprisers. Earth is just another developing planet. They're third world. So, yeah, I thought that line was kind of, it just plays right into that sort of, you know, message. And which is, I thought also was interesting, because compared to other alien invasion type narratives, especially the ones that come from like the, you know, 50s, 60s on up to now, most of the time, at least from the sort of literary criticism that I've read about these, the little bit that's out there, most of these have been interpreted as sort of the aliens are supposed to represent, you know, the communists are supposed to represent, you know, the Red Scare, and they're all like the Borg, it's collective hive mind. But in this movie, at least again according to Carpenter, it's the opposite. The aliens are the capitalists, the aliens are the free enterprisers, which I thought was an interesting juxtaposition there. So
is an inversion of the kind of typical idea of the invasion. I think this movie works brilliantly on a lot of narrative levels, and as I say, the visual metaphor of the glasses is just perfect, just absolutely perfect. So I think it does extremely well for what it intended to do, and I think John Carpenter should be proud.
It's a funny movie. It's a funny movie, I was going to say. You know, like I said at the beginning, just the one-liner after hilarious one-liner. So if you're into those sorts of movies,
I came here to chew bubble gum and kick ass.
And I'm all out of bubble gum. Love it. I love it, man.
Can you even imagine writing that line? Yeah. Anyway, exactly. So for anyone who has listened to our conversation without having watched the movie, although I can't imagine why you would have, absolutely go out and watch it. It is just a fun movie, but also, I don't know. I mean, do you think this might be possibly a tool for getting people to see the alt media and sort of, you know, broaching the conversation with people who might not be interested in this?
Perhaps. As I said, you know, at the beginning, I think the movie did well for the audience that perhaps wasn't already familiar with this before the sort of, you know, information age, internet age that we live in now, where this information is pretty widely accessible. I think the movie is very, very, I mean, obviously, as you said, it's very over the top, very overt in its message. But I mean, at the same time, it is very slick. As I said, it does. I do enjoy the way visually it's presented, the way the images are interspliced, the editing in the film rather quickly between, again, those there's one scene where it's, you know, he's looking at, you know, that the horrible economic situation that he's in, and the very next scene, this is prior to the glasses, the very next scene is that the fashion model and, you know, the press on nails commercial. So there is, you know, this, despite how obvious it is also at times, there is subtlety in the movie as well. And so I think it plays to both audiences. I think it can potentially get someone who is not already in tune with these ideas to watch a fun movie and see this and think, huh, that's interesting. Why did those TVs say obey? Why does it say, you know, doubt humanity on that newspaper? That's interesting. And on the other side of that token, there are people who are already in tune with this idea, or with these ideas rather, who can watch this film and really relate to it and see perhaps where some of this language that we use today may have come from, even. So I think it plays well on both levels.
I concur. Well, again, I think I would highly recommend this for anyone who hasn't watched it yet and who is interested in this subject matter, because, again, I think it's just very, very well done. All right. Well, if tracesofreality.com is one of those pairs of glasses that people can see the world through, I certainly hope people have tried them on before. But if not, please do go to Traces of Reality and tell us what you're working on these days.
Yeah, so the tracesofreality.com is the website, as you mentioned. I also do Demanufacturing Consent, the weekly podcast over on Bowling Frog's Post. Also, working as an editor for the Pan Am Post. You can check out, I don't write that often anymore, but when I do, you can either find it on my own website or over on the Pan Am Post. And there's a couple of other things that are in the works, but I probably shouldn't say or I'll jinx it. So I'll wait till next time until it's actually done. And then maybe we can talk about it.
We'll talk about the fait accompli.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Awesome stuff, Guillermo. Thank you as always. And thank you for getting me to rewatch this film and giving me an excuse. It's always good to have that excuse.
Indeed. No, I was grateful for the excuse myself. So thanks for that.
All right, friends, there he goes, Guillermo Jimenez. I, again, hope you will check out tracesofreality.com. That is our discussion for this month, and so now it's time to dip into the mailbag to talk about reactions to our program last month. And as people who are following this podcast at home will know, we were talking, of course, about B.F. Skinner's Walden 2 in the last episode of this podcast. I did get some positive feedback about that discussion, but unfortunately not a lot of very specific feedback, although there was this very interesting email from Junior Jailbird, who wrote in to say, "You mentioned a Melissa Paris Harry in your audio file, and I wrote her after taking in your audio file. No compliments from me, but I was civil. I suggested she be ashamed of her authoritarian attitude and anti-family unit message to the world. Anyway, what a fantastic work you created all by yourself. Very alive indeed. Thank you so much, Junior Jailbird, for taking the time to do that. As I did say in that podcast last month, I don't think we should give Melissa Paris Harry too much credit or attention, because, of course, what she is there to do at MSNBC is to be controversial and to say these things as a way of moving the conversational goalposts a little bit further. But at any rate, I'm glad that people do call these shills out for the types of ridiculous statements they're making about how we have to think about how the government really owns our children, not us. It's not we don't own. Why do we think of our children as our own? Anyway, I'll let you re-listen to that Melissa Paris Harry audio if you so choose. And hey, if you want to write these people and let them know what we really think of them, why not? At any rate, again, that will do it for this month's edition of the Film Literature in the New World Order podcast. So for next month, let me give you your homework assignment. We are going to be discussing the 2011 Hollywood drama directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Matt Damon, Kate Winslet, and Jude Law, Contagion. Yes, very apropos, one might say, to events that are unfolding at this moment, and who knows where we will be in that story next month, but we will be talking about Contagion next month on this podcast, so get ready, get prepared, and we will look forward to talking to you then. Until then, I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you, as always, for tuning in to this podcast, and looking forward to talking to you again real soon.